In the book of Exodus have brought us to what we generally call the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments can be divided up in various ways. Different groups and subgroups of them go together. Our passage this morning contains Commandments 2, 3 and 4, and they go together. They form a group. Why do I say that? Well, for one thing, these three commandments share a similar structure. In each case, you have the actual stipulation itself, and then you have the word for introducing a reason for taking the stipulation seriously. Verse 5, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Verse 7, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and so on. You don't get that structure with any of the other commandments, but it is shared by these three commandments. And then for another thing, the two outer commandments of these three, so commandments 2 and 4, they both contain allusions to the creation account, which we read earlier in our service, or we read part of it earlier in our service. They're in Genesis 1 and 2. Some of the allusions are very obvious, some are more subtle. I'll just mention one at this point that's somewhere between the obvious and the subtle. It's the reference in both commandments to that threefold division, heaven, earth, sea. That's very Genesis 1. It was there actually in the section that I read. And other creation allusions then in the second and fourth commandments will emerge as we go on this morning. So as I say, this trio of commandments does to some extent stand alone. Verses 4 to 11 are a unit. I'm not arbitrarily setting the boundaries of this morning's passage. This is a legitimate text for us to take. And the text begins then with this prohibition in verse 4 regarding making a certain kind of object. Now, if you just took verse 4 by itself, you might think that sculpture as an art form is being banned here, that Michelangelo's David and the Angel of the North and the four US presidents' heads on the side of Mount Rushmore all fly in the face of this commandment. But verse 5 makes it clear what the real issue is here. It's not sculpted objects per se, it's sculpted objects to which worship is directed. That's the issue. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. And almost certainly, it's the use of these objects in the worship of Yahweh that the commandment is targeting. Not bowing down to physical manifestations of Baal and Dagon and the like. They are other gods, and so bowing down to them has already been covered by commandment number 1. If commandment number 2 makes a distinctive contribution, if it isn't just a piece of dull repetition, if there truly are 10 different commandments and not just 9, then this must be about the worship of Yahweh. It's visualizing him that the commandment is concerned with. The verb visualize that I used just then has 2 different meanings. It can mean form a mental image of. I'm struggling to visualize the new road layout near Westmore once the engineers have finished their 27 weeks of work. That is, I'm struggling to form a mental image of it. Or it can mean actually make something visual. Put into visual form something that you wouldn't otherwise be able to see. And when I say that this commandment has to do with visualizing Yahweh, I'm using the word in that second sense, putting Yahweh into some kind of visual form, constructing an object which represents him. That's what I mean. And as we think about this, I want to ask a question. When God is visualized, what is happening? Specifically, and this may sound odd, but I think it is a fruitful avenue for us to explore, what is happening to man? And I'm going to propose this morning that when God is visualized, 2 things happen to man. By the way, I'm using the word man in this sermon in a generic sense. I could use humankind, but that's a bit cumbersome. So I'm going with the traditional man. I hope you aren't offended by that. When God is visualized, Two things happen to man. Interestingly, two opposite things. On the one hand, man's position is inflated, and yet at the same time, man's position is impoverished. Let's think about each of those in turn. So first of all then, when God is visualized, man's position is inflated. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness, and so it goes on. I'm sure that's an allusion, actually, to the creation account, a particularly biting one. Do you remember God's words there that we read earlier in our service? Let us make man. God makes man. God decides that man should walk upright on two legs. God decides that man should have the capacity to communicate through speech. God decides that man should come in two different but complementary forms, male and female. God decides what man is like. Man doesn't cooperate. Man doesn't have a say. Man doesn't choose the features and qualities that he wants to have. As subsequent biblical writers will put it, man is just the clay at the disposal of the divine potter. God is the maker. Man is the made. God is active. Man is passive. God is big. Man is small. But you see what happens when an idol is constructed to represent God. Man essentially tries to reverse the relationship. He inflates himself. He aggrandizes himself. He promotes himself beyond his rightful place so that he's now the one doing the making. He's the one doing the deciding. He decides, in the language of verse 4, whether God will perhaps resemble an eagle in heaven above, or perhaps a lion in the earth beneath, or perhaps a whale in the waters under the earth. He decides on the materials used and on the dimensions and on the place where the thing is going to be located. Man decides what God is like. Man is in the driving seat. Man is in control. Contrary to the true situation presented in Genesis 1, man is the maker, God is the made. Man is active, God is passive, man is big, God is small. Listen to Isaiah chapter 41 and verse 7. Here the prophet is describing the construction of an idol. And this is what he writes. The craftsman strengthens the goldsmith, and he who smooths with the hammer, him who strikes the anvil, saying of the soldering, it is good. And they strengthen it with nails so that it cannot be moved. And at one level, that's so pathetic, isn't it? Having to go along to B&Q and buy a set of nails to fasten down this thing that you're going to bow before in worship. At one level, the verse is exposing the sheer absurdity of worship involving idols. But at another level, it reinforces this idea that we're talking about, that such worship inflates man. Because it means you have a God who is dependent on man to stop his image from toppling over. A God who is at the mercy of man's DIY skills. Indeed, the stabilizing of the idol on its base, which Isaiah mentions here, that's only one area among many others where man will be needed. What about when the image is losing its shine and needs a new coat of paint? What about when the land is invaded by an enemy and the image requires special protection to prevent it from being plundered? What about the simple business of unlocking the doors and opening up the site at 9 o'clock each morning so that worshippers can access the image? In all of these areas, man sees to things. Man saves the day. Man keeps the show on the road. The God is indebted to him. The God is in a pickle without him. Man is big. God is small. I'm saying that's the invariable tendency when God is visualized. The second commandment isn't being pedantic. You know what it's like when you have a friend or a family member and this person has drifted in the Christian life. But then eventually you hear that he or she is getting involved in church again. And it isn't the kind of church that's really your cup of tea. Its style of worship and its position on some secondary doctrines you wouldn't consider to be ideal. But you don't care about that. You're just so happy that that person is part of a Christian church. And you might think, shouldn't God just be happy if his people are worshipping him rather than some other deity? Even if they are incorporating physical objects into that worship, surely that can be overlooked. Surely the second commandment is just over the top. God is being pedantic. No, he's not being pedantic. Incorporating physical objects into the worship of God isn't just a minor variation like adding another musical instrument in a church service. It's a seismic shift which actually redefines worship itself. It reconfigures the relationship between the one being worshipped and those who are worshipping. The latter are inflated. Instead of being small and dependent, they become big and in control. Now, I'm going to return to this point about man being inflated in a moment. But I suppose by way of parenthesis, I ought to say something about that part of the second commandment. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. Because those words are often, I think, misunderstood. The point here is not deferred punishment. One generation of Israelites breaking the second commandment and getting off scot-free, but then the following few generations having to pay the price and be punished in the place of the actual culprits. No, that's not the point. The point isn't deferred punishment. The point is perpetuated sin. That is to say, one generation of Israelites breaks the second commandment and is punished for it. But then because sin, a bit like the Omicron variant of COVID, is highly transmissible, the next generation repeats the behavior and is also punished for it. And then the next. And it takes three or four generations until there's some repentance and an abandoning of the images that have been used in worship. That's what's going on there in verse 5. I suppose the takeaway from that is what I'm going to call the concept of fragility. Fragility. And it applies well beyond the realm of the second commandment. The fact is that when a community of God's people loses its way, whether doctrinally or behaviorally or both at the same time, the deviant doctrine, the deviant behavior can very easily become set in and be perpetuated for a long, long time. It happens to churches. It happens to denominations. It happens to theological colleges. It happens to all kinds of Christian communities. They are fragile. We are fragile. At NREC, we must be prayerful and vigilant. Doctrinal and behavioral deviations only take a short time to adopt, but a long time to discard, if indeed they ever are actually discarded. Having said that, the purpose of verse 6 is to say deviations need not happen at all. Deviations need not happen at all. Israel's religion wasn't somehow booby-trapped so that it was inevitable that on a regular basis a generation would succumb to using images and thus start another three or four generational cycle. No, there was no reason why 1,000 successive generations shouldn't worship God faithfully and enjoy his unclouded favor. And similarly then, when we think of ourselves, yes, we must have a realistic sense of our fragility, which keeps us prayerful and vigilant. But we mustn't have a pessimistic sense of inevitability. Like Private Fraser in Dad's Army, we are doomed, we are doomed. Now, if Christ hasn't yet returned 100 years from now, there's no reason why, by God's grace, NREC shouldn't be a thriving gospel church. Why the Christian Institute shouldn't still be a biblically faithful organization. Why God's Word ministry shouldn't be a bastion of evangelical doctrine and godly behavior as it reaches out to the towns and cities of Malawi and beyond. This is what these two often misunderstood verses are about. They're about maintaining a delicate balance between sober realism on the one hand and yet humble optimism on the other hand. So that's the parenthesis. But back to the main point now. When God is visualized, man's position is inflated. Man's position is inflated. And let me add one more thing about that. I think there's a connection here to the third commandment. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Now, from what we know of the ancient world, I don't think the situation, the scenario being envisaged in this commandment is experiencing some kind of sudden surprise or experiencing some kind of sudden pain as you stub your toe or something, and in that moment of strong emotion, uttering Yahweh's name in a mindless exclamation. I'm certainly not saying that that would be okay to do that. That would doubtless be a vain use of Yahweh's name, and I think that you and I should be grieved when Yahweh's chief new covenant name, Jesus Christ, is just blurted out by people, as it so often is. But I'm saying we've no evidence that doing that was a thing in the ancient world. No evidence that God's names were mindlessly exclaimed in moments of strong emotion. And it's unlikely, therefore, that that's the scenario that's being envisaged. But you see, this is the thing. Yahweh's name could, in certain situations, be very useful to an Israelite. How could it be useful? Well, suppose an Israelite wanted to utter a barefaced lie and to make that lie sound very credible and very sincere and very heartfelt. There was a way of doing that. I swear by Yahweh, ... People were going to take that kind of language seriously. They were going to be impressed by it. You see what I mean about Yahweh's name being useful? But of course, that was a horrible abuse of the name. It was taking it in vain. Or here's another situation. An Israelite, possibly a whole generation of Israelites, had abandoned God's moral standards. In their homes and in the streets, they were leading totally immoral lives. But then, when those Israelites were at the synagogue, or at the temple, when they were engaged in religious activity, they wanted to look the part. They wanted to hide the drunkenness and the financial corruption and the sexual perversion and all the rest of it, and to pretend to each other, to God, to themselves, that they were pious. And so they would take on this reverent persona that wasn't really them, and which included talking lots about Yahweh, speaking of him so devotedly and in such hushed tones. And again, then, you see the usefulness of his name. And again, you see how it was being taken in vain. And when we understand the kind of scenario being envisaged in commandment number 3, we can perhaps appreciate its connection with commandment number 2. Commandment number 2 envisages a situation where man is in the driving seat, casting God as the kind of image which he deems suitable and being thoroughly in charge of that image thereafter. And commandment number 3 likewise envisages a situation where man is in the driving seat, making use of God's name when he finds it convenient and when it serves his interests to do so. In both cases, I'm saying, man is big, God is small. Man's position is inflated. And all I want to do by way of application here is throw out this question. In our Christianity, in your Christianity, in my Christianity, who is big? Is God big? Or is man big? We can easily practice a Christianity in which man is big. And God is this helpful safety net to us. And we enlist his services when life is bumpy and we're in a spot of need. But we are very much in the driving seat. And we live life on our terms. And there are areas of our lives in which God must not poke his nose. and has little interest in his fame and his cause and his kingdom as ends in themselves, only insofar as those things intersect with our own advantage. And we don't see ourselves as floodlights whose sole purpose in existing is to show forth the beauty and the magnificence and the splendor of Almighty God. Our Christianity can easily become like that. Let's beware any movement in that direction. Let's seek to have at the heart of our Christianity the kind of sentiments that we sang a few minutes ago. Before Jehovah's awesome throne, you nations bow with sacred joy. Know that the Lord is God alone. He can create and he destroy. His sovereign power, without our aid, made us of clay and formed us men. And when like wandering sheep we strayed, he brought us to his fold again. When God is visualized, man's position is inflated. But then secondly, notice with me, when God is visualized, man's position is impoverished. It sounds as though I'm contradicting myself, doesn't it? I've been saying that the construction of images makes man too big. It inflates him. How can I now be saying that the construction of images reduces man? It diminishes him. It impoverishes him. Well, this is the thing. When a man erects a statue and looking at that statue grandly announces, "This is the image of God," that man is denigrating himself, because he's right that God does have an image. God does have an image. But that statue that he's pointing at ain't the image. He is the image. He's the image of God. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, the triune God declared in Genesis 1:26. And tragically then, that man erecting that statue is surrendering his own colossal dignity as the image of God to a stupid, pathetic lump of metal. And this point then of man as the image of God, it's a point that you and I need to be clearer on than ever in our present context. And we're going to close reflecting on it, and reflecting on it in connection with the fourth commandment, the other one in our text this morning. We might be more accustomed to associating man as the image of God to other later commandments, especially, of course, commandment number 6 about murder. But man as the image of God shines through in commandment number 4. Commandments 2 and 3 have been concerned with the inflation of man. One concern of commandment 4 is that man shouldn't be impoverished, that his identity as the only true image of God should be recognized. Notice with me in that connection, just very quickly, 3 things which the fourth commandment highlights. First of all, the commandment highlights imitation. The commandment highlights imitation. Why is man to stop his labor and rest on the seventh day? Verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Now, we're used to this logic, aren't we? We've read Exodus 20 so many times. We're used to this logic. But when you stop and think about it, it's actually pretty mad, isn't it? I mean, if someone said to you, you should live in a big palace and be driven around by a chauffeur and give a speech every year at the state opening of Parliament because that's what the Queen does, you would say, well, I'm nothing like the Queen. Between her life and mine, there's a huge gulf. Just because she does all those things does not mean that I should do all those things. But Exodus 20 isn't saying, stop your work and rest on the seventh day because that's what the Queen does. It's saying, stop your work and rest on the seventh day because that's what God did. That's what God did. And the obvious response is, well, I'm nothing like God. Just because he did that, why does that mean that I should do that? To which the Bible's answer is, you're wrong. You're wrong. You are like God. Just like God, in fact. You're his very image. And if he stopped and rested on the seventh day, then there's every reason why you, his image bearers, should stop and rest on the seventh day. Isn't that amazing? Now, we don't need to go into details this morning about the new covenant change in the Sabbath, from it being the seventh day of the week to it being the first day of the week. Alan recently preached a series in which that was explained. Suffice to say this, when you and I keep the Sabbath, yes, in its new covenant, first day of the week, Lord's Day 4, when you and I keep the Sabbath, we are not giving expression to some kind of legalistic slavery to a now expired rule. That's what some sections of the Christian church will tell you. On the contrary, when you and I keep the Sabbath, we are giving expression to our supreme dignity as those who are God's own image and who therefore imitate him. You can't get more dignity than that. Treating Sunday as a day to do more work or more shopping or more sport, that's not freedom. That's impoverishment. It's living beneath our dignity as human beings in God's image. Keeping Sunday as a day of rest, that's godlike. That's us copying God and giving expression to this amazing reality that we are made in his image. Of course, the Bible stretches this idea, doesn't it, of imitating the one in whose image we are made beyond just keeping the Sabbath. There are all kinds of other areas too. Most comprehensively, be holy because I am holy. Again, you and I don't work at holiness in some kind of slavish, legalistic spirit because we're still trapped in the Victorian age and we haven't discovered that Christianity is about freedom, for goodness sake. No, we work away at holiness because we realize that we are God's image bearers. And he is holy. And it's our privilege, unlike any other component of the creation, to imitate God. Just think of one very specific area in which this applies. Paul's words there at the end of Ephesians 4 and the beginning of Ephesians 5. Ephesians 4:32. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another. And you kind of read that and you start to glaze over a bit. Oh, it's just, you know, typical Paul stuff about being nice to each other. And then suddenly he wakes us up from our slumber. As God in Christ forgave you, therefore be imitators of God. That's what we are doing when we have been wronged. And the person has come to us and asked for forgiveness. And instead of nursing a secret grudge for many years to come, we instantly forgive that person and are reconciled to them. We are imitating God. We are giving expression to this fact that we are made in his image. So the commandment highlights imitation. Secondly, the commandment highlights equality. It highlights equality. Very striking, isn't it? There in verse 10, on it, that's on the Sabbath, you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter. Well, that makes sense. But then it continues, your male servants or your female servants or the sojourner, that's the stranger who's not even an Israelite, who is within your gates. Think how counterintuitive that would have been to these Israelites who had been living for centuries as foreigners and therefore slaves in Egypt. Do you you probably won't remember, but way back in chapter 3, and at the end of chapter 3 of Exodus, we have this foretelling of the Exodus itself and the night that the Israelites are going to leave Egypt. And we read Exodus 3:21. This is Yahweh speaking, "I will give this people," that's the Egyptians, so no, that's the Israelites, "favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing." And I asked the question when we were looking at that many months ago now, why would Israelites and Egyptians be living in the same house? And the answer presumably is not that they were just kind of flatmates. The answer is that many Israelites were actually slaves within individual Egyptian homes. It wasn't just that the Israelites en masse were slaves of Pharaoh, but you also had a lot of Israelites who were slaves in individual Egyptian houses. And the Egyptians then lived lives of luxury and just heaped all the work on these Hebrew slaves that they had in their houses. That may be part of the reason why here in chapter 20, the passage we were looking at last week, we have that language in verse 2, "who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery," which would perhaps have had a special resonance for those listening who had actually lived in houses of slavery, where the Egyptians lived in luxury and they were the slaves working 24/7. And it would have been so natural then for the Israelites to just repeat what they had experienced now that they have their freedom. And any strangers that they have within their gates, to treat them as they had been treated in Egypt. Surely that's just what you do. And okay, the seventh day might be my rest, but it's jolly well not going to be my slave's rest, my foreign slave's rest. And yet there's this emphasis, isn't there, on equality. Everyone has to share in this rest. Everyone has to, regardless of their position in the household, regardless of their position in society, everyone is to enjoy the benefits of this rest. Why? Well, the only true basis for it is again this fact that we are the image of God. And the foreigner is the image of God. And the male servant and the female servant, they're the image of God. And therefore, they must be treated accordingly and must be treated appropriately. And this then is always, in any era of history and in any society, the only true and adequate and sustainable basis for treating human beings properly, isn't it? This concept that we are all made in the image of God. And we see that in our own society, don't we? Where we think we are so advanced and we think that we are now so civilized in our relationships to one another. And yet we have such enormous, gigantic blind spots. And we can put to death every year hundreds of thousands of babies. How is that possible in a modern society? Because our ethics are not based on this principle, that all share the image of God. And there's not much else that a little unborn infant so weak, we don't know yet, seems to share. It's disposable. Not if every human life equally partakes of the image of God. And we must be clear on it then at that level. But of course it applies to our own relationships with other human beings. I wonder, are there people who live in our city, in parts of our city, in our own neighborhoods? People with problems perhaps. People who have very broken lives. And we look down our nose at those people. And we cross to the other side of the street to stay away from those people. And we don't really believe that every single human being shares the image of God. We need to really get this into our thinking, not just at a theological level, but our intuitive thinking, how we view people. The commandment highlights imitation, it highlights equality. And then thirdly, the commandment highlights representation. Representation. Because there's one word I missed out, I think, a minute ago when I read verse 10. Your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, or your livestock. That's interesting, isn't it? Or your livestock. And so even the livestock, even the animals, were to share in the Sabbath rest. They don't have the image of God. Why then? Well, the point here isn't that the livestock have the image of God. It's back to the fact that the people to whom the command is being addressed and who are to look after the livestock are in the image of God. And you see, the point here is one of representation. So you remember how in Genesis 1, God creates everything. He creates the livestock. Livestock are mentioned there in Genesis 1. He creates the animals. He creates everything. And we see in Genesis 1, don't we, his concern. We saw it at the end of Genesis 1, that his concern for the animals. Verse 30, to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the heavens and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. So God is concerned for the welfare of the animals there. But rather than God himself directly walking this planet and literally ensuring that the animals are fed himself, God puts his miniature, his image on earth. Man, to represent him. He is the ultimate king, but he puts man as his miniature on earth to represent his rule and to steward the creation and look after the creation on his behalf. And that's why then, here in the fourth commandment, man is to be concerned for the animals. Because man is God's miniature and God is concerned for the animals. And man is representing his rule over the creation at ground level, if you like. And it's why you and I should be concerned for the creation around us. You and I should be concerned about the polar bear population and about the seabirds and how they are faring on the cliffs of our coasts and about the fish stocks and about the coral reefs and about the cleanliness or otherwise of the rivers and about the treatment of the animals that we eat in our Sunday dinners. Not because we are trendy and woke and have jumped on some bandwagon, but because we understand that we are God's image bearers and we are here on earth to represent him. He rules ultimately and he cares for all those animals and all those parts of the creation. And we then are to do that on his behalf. And we are to be concerned. Are we sometimes guilty of ignoring that? And thinking that my Christian responsibilities only relate to the Bible and prayer and being good to other people. We are also here on earth to carefully steward the creation for which God cares. And so, images impoverished man. They detracted from the fact that man is the image of God. We don't construct images. We don't have any images up here. But we can still have an impoverished view of man. Let's take seriously. Man as the image of God, imitation, equality, representation. Amen. We're going to